I'm Laura Vinroot Poole of Capital, and this is What We Wore. Meredith Melling is a former Vogue fashion editor and founder of the New York-based women's wear collection, Laline. I enjoyed sitting down with Meredith while she was in Charlotte and learning more about her journey, why she believes she's always learning, and the real value of taking risks. Meredith Melling, I'm so excited you're here, and we have loved having you in Charlotte. It's your first time in Charlotte, I think.
It is, yeah.
What are your impressions?
Everyone is so lovely. Oh. So lovely. Like, kindness overload.
Well, we've loved having you. You've been here for Western Week, our first Western Week that we nabbed from Brentwood, that they had a Western Week for the last several years, and everybody was so jealous here. And it's been so much fun. Thank you for coming.
I've happily leaned into the theme.
I know. We all have. You don't have to ask us twice. Will you tell the listeners where you're from?
I'm originally from Boston, outside of Boston. Oh. But I've now lived in New York longer than I ever lived in Boston. So,
how did you get introduced to fashion in Boston? Because I went to Andover and there definitely was zero fashion.
Yes. And I grew up around zero fashion. My father was an orthodontist and my mother was a child psychologist, but she definitely, if you wanted to stereotype like a quirky child psychologist, she was in her muumuus and like her paper mache jewelry and a very cool style, but not sort of the lane that I ended up going into. My husband is former military, and a lot of people in Manhattan, he's sometimes the first person who's ever served in the military that they meet. And they always say, how did you get into the military? You know? And he's like, I just always knew. It was like a part of my fiber, my being. Like, I always wanted to serve. And then there were certain things that happened in the course of his life along the way that led him to that service and becoming a Marine. And for me, it was kind of the same thing with fashion. Like, I have very like early memories of loving to play dress up in my mother's closet, paper mache jewelry and all. And then, you know, when I was in middle school, we got our first handheld like camcorder. Uh-huh. And I would host fashion shows. I would then have all my friends over and they would dress up in my clothes. And we had this big stairwell in our house and they would come down the stairwell and I would record them and then do the voiceover and say, and this is, you know, Annabelle wearing Benetton and, you know, and
Forenza.
Yes, at Camp Beverly Hills and all the labels. And then, and then in high school, I would, you know, start to buy myself nicer things or explore my personal taste.
Where would you shop in Boston?
I spent a lot of time at the Chestnut Hill Mall.
Oh, yeah.
Which was my local mall. And then I would, as soon as I had my license, I would go down to Newbury Street. And I have amazing memories from,
And the original Louis.
The original Louis Boston. Oh. Was where I really learned about, you know, designer fashion.
God rest its soul.
I know.
Ugh. Me too. I think that's where I learned. I mean, I can remember going in from Andover and just walking in and being like, oh my God.
Yeah. This is what fashion is.
Yeah.
God bless Chestnut Hill Mall. But, you know, this is really another level. And Boston misses that. Now, I feel like it's a real, nothing's replaced that.
Agree. Yeah. What made you think that you could be a great editor at that age too?
Well, so when I stayed local to the Boston area for college, I went to Tufts University. Go Jumbos. I loved it. But not a school that also set you on the path for a career in fashion. If you wanted to be a doctor or a veterinarian or an orthodontist like my father, the path was very clear for you. If you wanted to work in fashion, it was less so. And my friends always joked that I would carry around issues of magazines in equal measure to my textbooks. So anytime I was going to class, you know, I'd have like a Vogue and an Elle and a Harper's. And so I pored over the pages of magazines. But at that point in my life, I was willing to work in fashion in any capacity that fashion would have me. And to me, it was this big, like, fashion, you know.
And did you know anybody that worked in fashion, or how did you even know that that was a possibility, just because you saw the magazines and figured somebody made them?
Yeah. I didn't know anybody that worked in fashion, nor did my parents, nor did my immediate peers. I do want to give myself some credit for wherever I've gotten in my life, but there's so many things that were when I really think about a lot of luck and timing and whether I manifested that luck and timing or whether it's just pure luck and timing. So when I was a junior in college, I was dating someone at the time who said, if you really want to work in fashion, if this is the kind of, you know, what you appreciate, what you're seeing on the pages of the magazine, you really need to get yourself to New York.
And had you been as a child? I mean, did you all go?
I had been to visit my aunt, who's amazing, who's like a very powerful lawyer and has worked with the ACLU forever. And but her New York was always a little intimidating to me. That at the time, you know, the ACLU offices were in Times Square, which was pre-Giuliani, not very cleaned up. And then she lived really, really far uptown. And so, you know, I was like, New York was always a little bit intimidating to me. But I interviewed for an advertising job at an agency that was called Messner Vittieri Berger McNamee Schmetterer. And they made you say the name like that. You couldn't say MVBMS. You had to say Messner Vittieri Berger McNamee Schmetterer. And all the receptionists answered the phone like that. Yeah.
So what was your major at Tufts?
English major.
Okay, good. Well, good. You need that for advertising.
You need it for advertising. I know you do. Fashion, for everything.
You do.
And I spent the summer between my junior and senior year working for Messner Vittieri Berger McNamee Schmetterer. And I fell in love with New York. It was when Brad Pitt was dating Gwyneth Paltrow and they were always in Soho and I would see them on my lunch breaks. And I just thought, this is where I need to. I didn't want to go back for my senior year, honestly. And so I did go back. But it was an advertising internship. It wasn't really setting me on the path for this kind of career I'd hoped to get in fashion. I was spending a lot of time at our career center at Tufts trying to figure out what I was going to do. And one day I went and there was a posting saying, you know, publisher of Vogue, Glamour, GQ, looking for interns. And, you know, you could apply for an interview for an internship. So I was like, wait a second. So I applied. And then I love Tufts dearly, but the Tufts Career Center did call me and say, as a graduating senior, and I got accepted for the interview. And they called me to say, as a graduating senior, you are looking for a full-time job, not an internship. You're taking an opportunity away from a freshman, sophomore, or junior by taking this interview for an internship. And I'm like a very like guilty personality. I was like, oh, am I doing something wrong? And I talked to my parents and they're like, have they helped you in any other way to kind of get you on this course? Yeah. This is your chance. And so I kept the interview. I had the interview. And at the end of the interview, the Condé Nast HR representative was like, you'd probably be more interested in a full-time role than an internship, wouldn't you? And I said, well, yes, but luckily I have my aunt who lives in New York. I could live for free and, you know,
I'll do whatever it takes.
Yeah. I could make it work.
Yeah.
And they said, nice meeting you. I didn't hear from them, you know, about the internship, but I did get a call saying that there was a magazine, Mademoiselle, RIP, was a great magazine at the time, no longer published, that was looking for someone for a freelance position, a six-month role, going out on the road, driving cross country, hosting fashion shows on college campuses across America.
Oh my God. And did you do it?
I interviewed. I presented my spring trends. It was called Spring It On. And I went into the Condé Nast offices. I had everything on poster board because this is like, I didn't even have an email at this time. So I'm presenting on poster board Spring It On trends with all my collaging. Oh my gosh. I will tell you if you promise not to tell anyone else.
I won't tell anybody.
I know this is a podcast. I wore a suit from the Copley Plaza Mall, Bebe.
I love it. Yes.
It was
Bebe
like
it was awesome.
A lavendery mushroom color, like a kind of like pale color, little fitted jacket. It was kind of 60s, little mini skirt, and I wore black opaque hosiery with a little black heel and a little black like mock turtleneck underneath.
Cute.
That's what I wore.
That was good. That was intimidating. And so how did it go?
I didn't know right away. And so I graduated and all of my friends who were planning on going to law school or medical school or whatever had the summers off and they were planning a trip to Europe. So I was like, I don't know. I don't have anything lined up. So I guess I'll just go with you. And I have very low-key parents, so they were like, just call us once a week and let us know where in the world you are. So I would call them weekly from a payphone in whatever country I was in. And when I called my mom from Barcelona on Las Ramblas, she was like, Well, thank God, because you got the job at Mademoiselle and they keep calling me to be like, does she accept? Does she accept? Oh, she needs to be in New York. And I kept telling them, you're in Europe, but I'll hear from you any day now.
I mean, think about that, like how you had to call somebody to call. I mean, that's.
Yeah, they're calling my mom to tell me I got the job.
That's so awesome. And so that is so exciting.
I got on a plane that night and I went to New York like a day and a half later. Then I went on my cross country tour. Yeah.
Wow. And tell me about that.
Well,
how did you even know what to do?
I was the Mademoiselle representative. So I, you know, was hired. And the reason why they hired someone freelance for this job is I think because the year before they had had someone from the staff go, but it was so much back and forth. We went to 25 college campuses. Wow. And we started in Vermont and we ended up in Southern California. So at Pepperdine. So it was a very like, basically, it was an umbrella advertiser program. It was called the Life-O-Matic Tour. It was a terrible name, but lovely program. And they would sell in brands. So do you want to be part of the Life-O-Matic Tour? So like, you know, Tommy Hilfiger, Liz Claiborne, whatever. And they would accept, and then they would each get a segment in the fashion show that we did on these college campuses. And basically, the way it worked was we had our schedule, all the universities lined up. We would arrive on a college campus on one day. We would pepper the campus with signage saying, do you want to be a model in a Mademoiselle fashion show? Show up tomorrow at noon for your fitting. We would get, you know, a certain turnout for the fitting. We had sizes. It was very like we were ahead of our time. We had size 2 to 24.
Right.
So we could accommodate a lot of different body types and a lot of different kinds of beauty. These students would come, they'd get an outfit, I'd Polaroid them, and then they would have to report back at 4 p.m. for rehearsal, runway rehearsal. And we'd usually get a 50% drop off. And then after rehearsal, I'd be like, report tomorrow at high noon on your college quad to be in the fashion show. And I emceed the show.
Like you had before.
Like I my Spring It On presentation. Yep. And I'd be like, this is the Tommy Hilfiger segment. We'd have something fun to say about that. This is the Liz Claiborne segment. We have something fun to say about that. And it was great. You know,
I was like, what an amazing first job.
Yeah. I went right back to college. And so, and all these kids were like, how did you get this job? And I'm like, luck and timing.
Wow. So, and so how long did you do that?
Well, that was a 6-month gig.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, reported back to the Condé Nast offices at the end of it all. They were like, you did a great job, but there's, you know, we have a full headcount at Mademoiselle right now, but there's a position open at Vogue and they'd be curious to talk to you. I met with the team at Vogue. And at this point, I didn't really understand the difference between advertising and editorial. Right. I just was like, it's Vogue. It's Mademoiselle. So I interviewed for this job as a merchandising editor at Vogue, and I got it. So Ron Galati was the publisher of Vogue at the time, and Ron Galati was the inspiration for Mr. Big. He was dating Candace Bushnell, and so it was like a big character, big personality time at Vogue between Ron and Anna, Candace involved. I worked there in that role for about a year and a half, and I enjoyed it, but it really gave me the exposure to how the magazine world works, and I was going out doing things similar to what I had been doing for Mademoiselle. I was going out doing events for Versace, for Nordstrom, so for brands, for retailers, hosting fashion shows, you know, all kinds of different things. And I was the voice of the magazine. I was going out bringing the voice of the magazine to the customer, to the community. But what I really wanted to do is get behind the pages of the magazine. I wanted to be part of the team that was creating what then the, you know, people like me were going out and bringing to everybody else. So after about a year and a half, we had a publisher changeover. And I saw that opportunity as like, well, I'm not leaving, but new publishers like to bring in their own people. Yeah. So it's a great opportunity. I'll be like, I'll go and you can bring in whoever you want for this role. And that wasn't allowed. So again, it's another luck and timing thing. At that time, Condé Nast had a program called the Rover Program. Huh. Where if there wasn't an immediate role for you, but you were Condé Nast material, they could ease you into that Rover program and you'd work for a bunch of different magazines. And then if the position became a full-time position, you could potentially get hired.
Right.
And so I shifted into the Rover program and there was like, you know, it wasn't totally that smooth of a transition, but I had to quit all out and be like, you know what, I want to be an editor and I'm only 24 and you can't tell me I'm only on this track on the advertising side. I really want to make this change. And so I quit and then they said, never mind, come back in the Rover program. So I did that. And then I was roving and one day they called and they said, you know, have you met with the Vogue women yet? And I said, no, I'm roving at this publication that's more sporty. You know, we have – Condé Nast had a full breadth of publications. And I said, so I'm wearing like Carhartt pants and, you know, I don't feel like I'm Vogue ready. Could I interview tomorrow? She calls me back and she says, they say you could go today or never.
Oh, my God. So you're wearing Carhartt pants.
I wore Carhartt pants for my first interview at Vogue. And I was like, rawr. But I kind of I tried my best to explain myself. And then the next day when I was getting dressed for work, you know, I was like, you know what? I'm going to dress for the job I want, not the job I have or the job I would hopefully dream to get one day. And I remember I wore a pencil skirt and Manolos and you know, my colleagues where I was working, they're like, whoa, what do you have going on? Do you have a cocktail party after work or something like that? And I was like, yeah, I got to go out after work. And then that day they called again and they said, you know, Anna Wintour would like to see you. Can you be downstairs in 5 minutes? I went downstairs. 10 minutes later, you got the job.
Wow.
So it all moved very quickly. As soon, you know, wow. Vogue is very decisive. They make their decisions fast. So, and then I stayed for 16 years.
Wow.
So.
When you were in the Rover program and when you were in actually the merchandising position,
yeah.
Did you feel confident that whole time that you knew what you were doing? I mean, at 24?
Yeah. So when I was in on the advertising side, so the public speaking thing was never like the most comfortable thing for me, like at all. Mm-hmm. Like I would sometimes vomit before I would have to go on stage and I'd just be at a mall, like the Paramus Mall at a Nordstrom and doing their fall fashion show with Vogue. And I would puke before I went on stage. And so that part always gave me so much anxiety. And it ultimately wasn't as creative as deeply inside I felt I wanted to be. You know, we were very much I wasn't styling the fall Nordstrom fashion show. I was showing up and saying Vogue endorses all these trends and it's me here to, you know, talk you through the trends. Right. They had stylists. I almost would rather have been the Nordstrom stylist than me being this like, you know, figurehead for Vogue. So I did sometimes feel like I didn't feel totally confident in the role either. I just didn't feel my best self. Like I thought graduating in this, like into higher roles in this sort of on this track didn't feel like where I really wanted to be. But I was also so grateful to just have like, I got to the fashion industry and I got to Vogue.
And so you got to New York,
You know, just this kind of, these two voices in my head. But at the time, it was just like such a different climate, like advertising and editorial were church and state. You know, I remember Vogue, there was the 12th floor and the 13th floor, and it was like never the two shall interact. And so when I said I wanted to move over to the editorial side, it was like, well, you'll never do that. Like, how are you going to do that? Like, why would you want to do that? You're going to make no money. You're going to have to work crazy hours. Like, you're on a track. And I thought, yeah, but I don't even like think I like what I'm doing. For me, going into the Rover program was really interesting because I had to one of the first jobs I had was back at Mademoiselle working with a stylist. I had one of the biggest like, you know, check yourself Meredith moments was, you know, I had so much autonomy. I was traveling everywhere doing these kinds of shows. Like people wanted my opinion. Not as a styling assistant. Nobody wants your opinion. You just need to be there to watch and learn. And when the stylist says, get me the gold bracelets, only bring the gold bracelets. Don't also bring the turquoise or whatever else you think. Maybe just only bring the gold bracelets. Only, you know, that was a big like learning curve to be like, okay, yeah, this is a start over. You have so much to learn. And you know what? The lesson there is like, I'm still learning, you know, like every day from the people I work with, from my customers, like we're just always learning. So, you know.
I mean, hopefully you are. You know, I don't know that most people are completely open to that because it's not easy, I think, to listen.
Yeah. I know, but with the world, I mean, the industry, again, is changing so much with the introduction of AI and the way people consume. I'm sort of like, I need to bring all the experts around me sometimes for this. Yeah.
So you were there for 16 years. And what was the most meaningful project that you did there?
There were so many things that were so amazing. I'm definitely, you know, I worked really hard and there were really challenging times, but I really loved my time at Vogue. And I did. That's when I finally, I was like, how did I get this job? Like, I can remember being that junior, you know, like, you know, not applying for that, to that piece of paper, you know, tacked to the bulletin board in my career office. So I really like loved everything. The most meaningful thing that I think I was a part of at the magazine was the like development and kind of like rollout of the CFDA Vogue Fashion Fund. Mm. That was a really pivotal moment for me. I mean, that was, there were a lot of terrible, obviously 9/11 was a horrible day and there were a lot of terrible things that happened. It also happened in the middle of New York Fashion Week. A lot of designers' shows were canceled, and a lot of those designers, Donna Karan would be fine, Calvin Klein will be fine, but there's a lot of young designers who you invest so much money in putting on those shows, and if your show gets canceled, you lose that money. Editors and buyers don't show up to your show because it's canceled, you lose that money, you lose that order, and then your business is at a fragile state, so will you stay in business? And so we did something in the immediate wake of 9/11. We reported back to work and we put on with a group of 10 designers a fashion show. We did it in Mrs. Herrera's showroom. We had no music. Josh Patner, who was the designer for Tula at the time, made opening remarks. We had all volunteer models. So any models that were still in town that like, you know, were couldn't get like leave town because flights were so limited, walked for us. And we had 10 designers and we called it the American View.
I love it. Aw. I remember it at the time, too. I mean, I was just starting out, too, and you think about all – I mean, even to say Josh Patner, you know, the people doing things in their apartments.
Yeah. Benjamin Cho, like all these kind of real creatives that were
– What an extraordinary thing that y'all did. And I think – I don't know that Vogue always gets the credit for doing things like that for designers and entrepreneurs. Or for understanding the hardships that they face.
Yeah. I mean, that show became the American View the next season, which was then we focused on two designers. So we brought Rick Owens, who was an LA-based designer at the time, to New York. I think he said yes. And then he was like, what did I sign up to do? You know, he's so edgy. And we were like, you're an American View. And then the other designer was Benaz Serafor.
Benaz was amazing.
And then Anna was like, we really need to. So then we established the CFDA Vogue Fashion Fund. And I oversaw that. You know, I was the direct liaison with all the designers for, you know, the time that they were in the fund and going through the process. I called myself camp counselor. I was available to them 24/7 and helping them in any way I could. And so I made so many relationships. The Costello guys, so many big, bright, bold names went through that program. That was a really, like, proud kind of accomplishment to see the way that program carries on and, you know, creates, like, I mean, that visibility for those designers goes such a long way. And I think that that's – when I got to Vogue, I was, you know, obviously so grateful. And what I learned about myself is that, you know, there was – at the time when I started at Vogue, it didn't necessarily have a reputation for, like, everyone being nice, you know?
Yeah.
And everyone really is, but it's a tough work environment. You got to like just keep pace. And so I don't know if it's because I'm from small town Boston or whatever, going into big city New York, but I think I got a long way for being nice.
Yeah.
And it was a little surprise when they met me. Wow. And I made a lot of relationships and I thought, you know, for a lot of these young designers, some of them, you know, made it into the fashion fund. Some of them made it into the pages of the magazine. Some of them were just really chugging along and trying. And I would say, you know what? I can give you 5 to 10 minutes of my day for you to bring your collection up and see your clothes. And I know the blood, sweat, and tears that goes into that. And then I know you can go and say to your Saks Fifth Avenue appointment or Bloomingdale's appointment. Vogue. Just met with Vogue.
Yeah.
They loved this piece. You know, I know the value of that. So just, you know, it's cool to be nice.
I mean, it's such a hard business. You know, it's such a, I mean, you're kind of like, wow, are you sure you want to do this?
Yes. I'm like, if I know now, what I know now, then I don't know what I.
Yeah, actually, yeah. So tell me about your first impression of your Vogue colleague, Valerie Boster.
So she started, we overlapped for 10 years at Vogue, and she's a native New Yorker, and she, you know, again, I've lived in New York now longer than I ever lived in Boston, but I can never claim to be a native New Yorker because I don't have that, you know, if the French girls have a je ne sais quoi, I don't know what it is that New York girls have, but they have something. And so
did you ever talk about leaving and starting a business together?
So there was a certain point where a lot of things were happening. The industry in general was changing. You know, when I started at Vogue, there were two major collections a year. You had the spring summer shows and the fall winter shows. And pre-seasons like resort and pre-fall were filler mostly for mm-hmm. wholesale partners. They were pretty kind of commercial collections. A lot of our editors wouldn't even, you know, look at them. So we would really spend like six issues a year rounding out storytelling for the spring summer collections and then another six for the fall winter collections. And then with the advent of social media and increasing visuals, the pre-collection shows started to become more relevant, that we needed more, like social media needed more. You needed more newness.
Yeah.
The stores needed more newness. So when those collections became really big and then suddenly we're flying around, Karl Lagerfeld's flying in an iceberg for Chanel, like everything was becoming super amped. And, you know, we're keeping up with the trends for the pages of the magazine and for Vogue.com. And I just thought, God, what is the customer thinking? Like, it's like 1 minute it's this, 1 minute it's that. When I looked around the Vogue offices at my colleagues and peers who truly had every designer relationship, could probably take something right off the runway if they wanted to jump on the latest trend. So many of them were wearing like Breton striped t-shirts or like a men's Charvet shirt that they picked up at the clothes in Paris. And it was like, you know, it's one thing to like appreciate all the trends, but what are we actually wearing?
Yeah.
You know, and we all love fashion. We all loved all the trends. We all kind of like, but what are we actually wearing? And that was like a big aha moment and kind of, you know, light bulb moment for how and why we started Laline. And so I remember walking into Valerie's office one day. She was the bookings editor. So she got an office, a closed office, because the models had to change clothes in there. I was like, what about just like stripes and lines? Like, what if we just start there? And it's like, we, you know, cut through the noise and we just have, and she was like, yeah, I'm in.
Wait, and so did y'all start Lamarck before that, your consulting business?
Yes. Yeah, so I love to ask questions. I love to get advice. I don't, again, like, I think I'm always learning. I know I'm always learning. So Andrew Rosen, who owned Theory at the time, you know, he was kind of one of the first people that after we'd been talking about this idea for Laline, like a company kind of focused on stripes and lines, we went to someone who we had a close relationship with, who's built brands, who supported young designer brands. And we said, what do you think about this idea? And he said, you've been exposed to some of the like highs and lows of being a designer, but really when you get out there and you try to do it, it's a very different beast than where you are now.
Yeah.
It would benefit you to spend some time really like working with brands and consulting with brands before, and then, you know, take what you learned in consideration if you still want to start your own brand, or maybe you want to go work for a brand instead. And so we took that into consideration. And so the reason Lamarck had that name is because it was like a riff on Laline. So we had already kind of like in our heads had this baby Laline. We didn't know if we could trademark that name or anything like that at the time. So then Lamarck was like, you know, the brand. And we went out and it was a great time to kind of go out and work for brands because it was a time when brands were amping up their content. So when we left, a lot of brands, like their websites were really dry and boring. Their Instagram feeds were often being left to like an intern to do. There wasn't kind of the attention or focus on those channels for brands that there is now. And so it was a great opportunity for us to go in and help them like boost and amplify their content. And so we had amazing partnerships. Like we had amazing supporters when we did that. But the real goal of Lamarck was to kind of go work with some brands. And along the way, we ended up having all these amazing girls that Valerie and I had worked with through styling for the Met Galas and all the Vogue events come to us and say, oh, could you guys like, I'm working on my personal brand. So then that was another thing. And how you presented yourself on the red carpet and went out was like kind of a, how you, your personal brand. And so we started doing styling and that's how that kind of evolved.
Were you amazed at the difference of just information you were receiving on the other side of Vogue, I guess?
Yeah. I think the biggest, I think we were in a very kind of unique position at Vogue to focus a lot on what we just liked, you know, like, do we like it or not? Is it like, is it the next thing or not? And we didn't have to factor in a lot of other things like how many units of that item did they make, you know, like how much does it cost? You know, we could just like things for them being special and moving the needle forward in fashion or, you know, or being innovative in fashion. And so on the brand side, I got a lot of introduction to all these other considerations that, you know, before a brand does anything, you know, put something out, they have to kind of evaluate all these other things. So it was not just about, do we like it? It was about how much is it going to cost to make?
Yeah. Can we sell it?
Can we sell it? Yeah. If we can't sell it, what do we do with it? Yeah.
And was it scary? I mean, were you scared?
No, I wasn't scared because I became more and more kind of like convinced that we were onto something with our brand. Mm-hmm. And Valerie and I were also very aware that spending time on the brand side made us even amplified the fact, our awareness even more that we really needed a business partner. We really needed someone with spinning our wheels creatively on what Lillian could be, but like really like mapping out a business strategy was something that our backgrounds were not in and that we really needed someone for. So I think I knew that we needed to do that, having met all these designers who probably start a brand because they have a creative idea, but then they're forced to be the COO, the CEO, the head of HR, all these things.
They need their Andrew Rosen.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And so that was like crystal clear after spending time.
And that's how you met Molly Howard.
Yes, we were introduced through a mutual friend, Sarah Howard, no relation. We met her under different circumstances. Like we didn't meet her necessarily to talk about Lalene. We met to talk about the brands we were working with. She was overseeing business development at Rag & Bone and took them through a big fundraise and was kind of ready to look for her next opportunity and was thinking she might work with a bunch of different brands, and we were working with different brands, and were there any synergies? And when we met her, we were like, oh, she's who we need. We want Molly. And so we scheduled another meeting.
Yeah. And did you convince her quickly? I mean,
pretty quickly. So we sat it. We were like, okay, we have this idea. And she said, let me take it and come back to you. When she came back to us, she had done a full like business plan. And she was like, it has to be direct to consumer. We have to, you know, she's like, and I'd love to do this. I'd love to do this with you. Wow. So, and then we were, the team was formed.
And was that the moment where you thought that this business could be successful?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because everything she was saying anchored the creative felt sort of lofty at times, and everything she said kind of made it all come together. It was like, yeah, we can do that, but this way in execution. And so it felt very real then, you know?
Yeah. And tell me about working with two partners. What's that like?
We have a rule basically as three partners, majority rules is our rule. So, you know, I think if you have two partners, sometimes you hit a standstill. I want to do it this way. I want to do it this way. Well, now what? Who makes the decision? And, you know, it's not like we have a board or anything that's deciding what direction Lillian's going to take on anything. So there's three of us. And so we always said, okay, so the deal is it's no hard feelings and majority rules. And sometimes you're in the majority and sometimes you're in the minority. And sometimes it's unanimous, you know. So, but it really like kind of like cuts out any of the hurt feelings and like, sure, if you have something you were hoping the brand would do and majority ruled in a different way, you're like a little bruised for like an hour and then you're moving on because you're so busy, you've got other things you have to do. So because it really does, it's like that's just the way we decided to operate. So
and it's worked well.
I mean, and it's worked well. Yeah.
Since 2016.
Yeah. 8 years.
Yeah, that's a long time.
This April is our 8-year anniversary.
That's a really long time. Yeah. And also to add the pandemic in it is you know, an extra 10 years pretty much. Yeah. You brought up something interesting in the pre-recording questionnaire, which was risk. What led you to the seminar about risk?
Oh, my gosh. Well, my husband is a former Marine, but he's also like a big hippie. So I went to my first Burning Man with my husband. And we went to see a speaker, and it was a seminar on risk. And I had always thought of risk as downside risk. Like, if I do this, what horrible things are going to happen to me? Because it's risk, you know? I just had a negative association with risk. And then this speaker really reframed it for me or for the group and was like, you know, what upside risk? Like, if you don't do it, what won't you learn about yourself? Right. If you don't do this, what won't you become? And I was like, yeah, I gotta do this. So that was a big – so I think about risk in that way. When something's scary to me or something feels like I think about all the things that could possibly go wrong, I have to reframe and think about all the things that I might not – experience or discover or, you know, or feel if I don't.
What's the most recent business risk that you've taken?
Launching denim, which is hard.
But it's awesome. You look so great in it.
Awesome. But it's so hard. It's such a beast.
And because of volume or because so many people do it?
I think we felt very confident in doing it. You know, we always featured denim on our website because we always try to take this really real approach to dressing and clothes and try to be in like a real mindset. And so we were like, you know what? Women aren't wearing our sweaters with skirts all the time or other things that we had in our ready-to-wear collection and trousers. They're wearing it with jeans. Yeah. And so we would put our jeans on the website and everyone would ask, what are the jeans? What are the jeans? And we're like, ugh. And so happy to send business to Frame and Redone and all our favorite jeans out there. We were like, it's a real natural fit, it seems. So, but again, it's like, know what you know what you don't know. And so we all as founders were like, we know that this is like, and Molly had spent a lot of time at Rag & Bone, you know, obviously. So she understood it's so nuanced and like the fabric varieties, wash varieties, fixturing varieties, it's daunting. And so.
Are they all made in LA?
No, our consultant who does a lot in LA, but we do a lot in Turkey with our denim. And so it's we knew we had to hire a consultant, an expert to do it, but we started development before COVID. Hmm. And so it was a long time coming and we ended up launching in February of last year. So,
and do you think people have changed? I mean, the kind of denim they want, I would say just shoes more than anything.
Yeah.
I've noticed such a change in shoes and the shoes that people want now. They're really not willing to do a high heel ever again after the pandemic. They're just like, this is done.
And when sweatpants became all the rage during the pandemic, we were like, let's put a pause on denim development and just see where we net out on this. And then, you know, when people were returning to work, there was, but it definitely, we were like, it's got to be, you know, we had started development with, you know, we're like, where do you even begin with denim? Mm-hmm. So we were like, we'll start with the Meredith, the Molly, and the Valerie jean. And it'll be like a style that's sort of signature to our style. So mine was like a cropped flare. Mm-hmm. Molly's was a straight leg, like non-stretch, and Val's was a skinny jean stretch. Those were well into development, but then pause. And then so when we picked up development again, we were moving forward with those, but also thinking ahead. And so the thinking ahead was like, we need jeans that are going to give us the comfort of sweatpants. Like we need to carry some of that comfort forward.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like the jeans I'm wearing today, the Marilyn, you know, kind of a barrel leg, like not fitted on your thighs, you know, very comfortable. We have the Isadora, the wide leg jean. We have like our jean jackets. New jean dresses are coming out. Denim dresses are coming out this week. So
the skirts are great too.
Yeah, the skirts are great. So
that's like a whole different part of your brain that you've never used before.
Yes, I'm learning. See, I'm still learning.
But how does it feel to be working on a store in your hometown?
Really exciting. I'm going to cry again. But really exciting.
Yeah.
And I know Boston, I know you got it in you. I know you've been missing some fashion. We're hopefully going to bring it to you.
Oh, you're going to crush it in Boston.
It's cold at least. We'll sell lots of sweaters, I hope. But I enjoyed spending time there. I don't really have family. My mom just moved back there, but for a while she'd been living in New York with us. So I have two new reasons to spend a lot more time back in Boston between my mom and then my new baby.
And yeah. is it on Newbury Street?
It's on Newbury Street, awesome. 135 Newbury Street. It's going to be so cute. It's big for us, you know, square footage wise, but small by comparison to Capitol.
When everything will be produced by you, everything is yours?
Everything is Laleen. Yeah. We do, in all of our stores, we bring in trunk show partners, which is really a fun way to just, you know, like kind of broaden the breadth of the assortment that we have on any given day in the store. So we'll definitely do a lot of that. I know there are like lots of kind of like small creators in the Boston area who have something to show. So we're happy to like create a space for them to do that. We have the space. Like I said, it's our big store.
That's neat.
Yeah. And I'm really excited. I'm really, having gone to college also in Boston and spent a lot of time on Newbury Street, I'm really excited for like that age group, that community to come on in and spend some time.
Also the other best store that used to be in Boston was Allen Bilzerian.
Yes.
The best. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that feels important to share about your personal story or about Laleen?
No, I think that, you know, the other thing that I'm sitting at the table with this amazing group of women and we're all moms and we're all working and we're all balancing it all. And I think with Mother's Day coming up, it's that balance that, you know, kind of.
I mean, you have four children.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how you did that or have been doing that. Because you're still doing it. You have a five-year-old.
I'm like, well, and I think like every day I sort of feel like I was a shitty mom and I was a shitty boss and, you know, and I'm sort of – and then you just, you know, at the end of the day, you just got to like let it all go and be like, are my kids loved? Yes. Like that's the most important thing. Is my company – like my company's doing well. So like the microaggressions I put on myself for not, you know, doing a certain thing, like overall, like everything's going great.
You had your first baby while you were at Vogue, and we were talking earlier about going back to work 2 months after she was born and just the grind of it all. Have you done things differently with this business because of that or in light of that, I guess?
Yeah, well, in terms of like my growing family, you know, Laleen started out of my living room. So I had my baby and my company was right there. So I was on maternity leave and building a brand out of the same apartment. And that was for Wolf in India. And then by the time I had Wilder, we had office space. So when I was at Vogue and there was a different kind of flexibility, you'll call it, in terms of
or inflexibility.
And so we're very much like if you have a doctor's appointment and the only time your doctor can see you is at noon, go. You know, things like that. We try to be, you know, we have a very flexible vacation time policy. Like if you want to go on vacation. And I think a lot of things that are different now is we can all Zoom. Mm-hmm. COVID has taught us we can all really get things done remotely. So if you, you know, want to be in Bali that week or whatever, you can work remotely. If you're doing your job, you do it from Bali. Yes. I went right back to work after all these babies. My husband jokes when I was on my computer when I was in labor with Wolf, but he was also on the computer. And I was like, what are you doing? And he was like shopping on Amazon or something. And I was like, I was like, you're not here for me. You're not present. And he's like, well, you're on your computer. He was like, let's both put our
computers
away.
What are we doing?
What are we doing? Let's put on a cool, easy listening kind of song. Get us through this. Let's go. But yeah, so I don't know.
Four children is no joke. I mean, that's a lot.
I have to let a lot of things go. Like I'll come home sometimes and a scooter will whiz by me in my apartment. And I'm like, that's happening in my apartment. I just have to let it go. I'll hear soccer ball being kicked somewhere. And we live in like a old artist loft. So it's like, you know, not too precious, but still I'm like, okay, just four kids. That's what happens. You live in an apartment in New York. You gotta let.
Exactly.
Gotta let them live.
Very important question. What did you wear to prom? And I can't wait. I want to hear what you got at the Chestnut Hill Mall.
Oh my God, wait. Which prom?
Oh yeah.
I want to spend another 30 minutes talking. talking about prom. But I will say, okay, so this impacted every prom. I went to prom my sophomore, junior, and senior year. So
same date? No, it has to be junior, senior.
So sophomore year, I went with a junior, yeah. And then I went to my junior prom, and then senior year, I went to my prom, and then I went to the Belmont Hill prom as
okay.
well.
Oh, yeah.
So, but the most fun story is about what I wore to my senior prom. But quickly, my mom wouldn't let me wear black or sheer black hosiery. Weirdly, my bohemian child psychologist mom but had some rules from her like Catholic schoolgirl upbringing. So she was like, no.
I wasn't allowed to wear a black bathing suit or white.
Oh, interesting.
It had to be color.
Had to be color bathing suit.
Yeah. Which is so odd.
That's funny. When I was a sophomore, I went to junior prom. I call it my Judy Jetson dress because it was like black and white polka dots. But it had a hard wiring in the cool. layers that made it them float three different tiers.
And was it short or it was long?
It was short, but I wore white hosiery with it.
That's
so,
kind of cool, like sheer white?
Sheer white hosiery.
That's kind of cool.
White shoes.
I like that. It was like late 80s.
It was 1999. Yeah. I graduated high school in 92. So yeah, like 89.
I love it.
And then my...
That sounds very on brand.
Yeah. My junior year, I wore this black and gold situation. This was strapless. That was strapless. This was strapless. And it was a Lily Rubin.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you remember Lily Rubin.
Yeah, of course I do. Of course. That was like, Chestnut Hill Mall for sure.
Yes. Black with gold embellishment on the top. Gold, like kind of foil skirt. And then with a big rosette. And then gold sparkle nude leggings. With a black shoe, because no, yeah. God forbid, I wear sheer black.
Oh, my God. Okay.
And then my senior year was, we all went as like a big friend group. It wasn't so mm-hmm. much dates. And so my friend Kelly Grant and I went into Newbury Street. Mm-hmm. And there was a store at the time that was outfitting a lot of the new kids on the block. And we were like,
like the actual new kids
the
on
band.
The block.
Yeah, yeah. So we're like, yeah, let's go in there. And so we went in there and Mark Wahlberg, who was not in the New Kids on the Block, but was Marky Mark, was in there. Yeah. And so we're trying things on and we tried on these satin quilted shorts with like a big zip, like
what
a
color?
Chunky zipper, navy and rust. She tried on navy. I tried on rust. And we came out and Mark Wahlberg was like, those are hot.
Oh, no.
Those are hot.
No.
So got those. But I also got a trash bag skirt, like very
That's
Balenciaga,
cool.
right?
Yeah, I love.
Like it was like kind of a big puffy
taffeta,
trash baggy taffeta. Yeah, right. Like we all called it my trash bag skirt. So I got that was for prom.
And was it Betsy Johnson? No.
No, it was some... I wrote about it on my Instagram and then I was like, what was the name of that store?
And somebody responded.
Somebody responded with the name and I was like, that's right, that's what it is. And of course, I have this mom brain. That's one thing with motherhood. It's a sieve. I can't even remember.
And so what top did you do back to the trash bag?
I did a black Donna Karan bodysuit with a trash bag
Whoa,
skirt.
Oh, that's cool.
So,
and then were you allowed to do black hose with that?
And then I did black hose with that.
Even like
year.
You left the house and got into the limo and put them on.
Well, because I went with a friend group. We all got dressed at
exactly.
my friend Kristen Fristino's house. And so, and her mom didn't care what
yes.
color hosiery I wore.
Did it have polka dots on it?
No, we were in a solid era. Yeah. And I think I did wear like a big paper mache kind of earring. Like definitely my mom inspired long.
That sounds cool.
Tangly thing, yeah.
That's a good one. Those are really good ones.
Yeah.
Those could be the best three we've heard from one person.
And it was like, I guess it was when I had some choice because when we would go to like the country club formal, it was always Laura Ashley.
Yes.
And it was like exploded sleeves and, you know, floral or like velvet and taffeta.
Yeah, girl.
So prom, I really just let my freak flag fly, clearly.
I love it.
But, yeah.
Aw, thank you so much for
thank
this.
Thank you.
Really appreciate you taking the time
thank
and for
you.
Coming to Charlotte.
Oh, my gosh. I've had the best time. Thank
Thanks,
you.
Thank you. What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drozda. Please follow us on Instagram at What We Wore Podcast for additional content and show updates.
QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.